One evening in the beginning of July, I had the opportunity to interview Nancy Halifax. Nancy is a professor at York University in the Critical Disability Studies graduate program. She's also an artist and has a beautiful way of weaving her art into her research. Her research focuses on the body and representation, feminist theory, gender, knowledge translation, the social determinants of health, and social justice. What follows is the conversation that we had in July 2009.
Okay, so maybe if we could just start with, if you could just introduce yourself and tell me a little bit about your role as a professor, as a researcher, as an artist.
Okay. Let me think. Thanks, Ilona, first of all, for letting me talk. So, of course, enjoy conversations. So, a little bit about myself. I've been, I guess, in those roles as professor, researcher, and artist, they're all congruent with one another. And I would say that I've been an artist and a researcher longest. And I think that as an artist, artists are always doing research. And it's kind of one of those hidden things that culture doesn't really associate with artists, maybe a bit more now than it used to. And so all of my artwork has always been involved with social justice issues, equity issues, issues around gender, violence, the body. And so those interests kind of carried on into my work as a faculty member at York. I'm currently working in critical disability studies.
And how long have you been working there?
2 years now.
Okay, maybe you could talk a little bit about your involvement in homelessness research.
Okay. I've been involved in homelessness research for a long time, and I even don't even like to think about how long it is because there's been so little change, right? And when I talk to people about it, I think one of the biggest things is that it moves slowly. Change in Canada, for some unknown reason, is achingly slow. It's too slow. And that's probably why I continue doing what I'm doing, because it's also really, really important research, working with people who, you know, are without homes. And I mean, the people I work with at York, at the Homeless Hub, have come up with a very broad definition of homelessness, which involves everything from being insecurely housed, couch surfing, living in, you know, inadequate housing, to actually living on the streets. Right. So homelessness to me encompasses a broad range of things that involve kind of what it is to be poor in Canada today, right? And live with really no resources. So you're under-resourced in an over-resourced country. Mm-hmm. So I use the arts in my research a lot.
How do you use the arts in your research?
Okay, I'll tell you.
Okay.
And I think that comes from my role as an artist, as that kind of trying to bring that congruency. I'm a qualitative researcher, so the work I do is very much based on kind of, how it is to live in a particular manner. Talking with people, working with people, research. Is qualitative research is such that it's not about numbers, it's not about kind of proving, theorems or anything. It's very much about trying to understand, in my case, lived experience. So it's very phenomenological, and the arts lend themselves very well to phenomenological research. I've done a couple of projects with Street Health, and they've been involved from day one, with Street Health. It's been very interesting because in community-based research, you want to go in and you want to be very much aligned with the community. And Street Health had already done a series of focus groups with people who are homeless. And so I think, but I really want you to know that every time I say that word homeless, I'm applying that whole range of experience. So they had come up with maybe 5 things from those focus groups that people wanted to look at. So in talking to the executive director, Laura Cowan, she and I hit upon one that we thought would make a lot of sense in using the arts, and that was A Day in the Life. So that involved a group of people meeting we got funded, and we met for way longer than our funding was accountable for, but people didn't want to leave the group. It was a very key part of their lives, and I think that's another thing with the arts and research. Adds a real different flavor. So people are actually coming in, they're really engaged. right. in creating something that they're going to show to people. So the arts and research involve everything from, you know, the very beginning to the very end, to the research methods, to defining the questions, and then to the dissemination of the research, to how you're going to reach your audience. Mm-hmm. So we were looking at, with this group of people, what is it like to be homeless in Toronto? So we ended up doing a number of different community events. We took, you know, a couple of thousand photographs, talked about them, looked at them, and came up in the end with a small series of photographs, actually, that are still showing. And they're large prints with writing on them. They're large black and white prints with writing that really talk about, you know, each photograph will have a quote on it.
Right.
And it really talks about what that person's life is like on the streets in Toronto.
Where does the quote come from? Is it coming from?
It comes from them directly, yeah. Yes.
And where is the project being shown right now?
It's not being shown right now,
okay.
But it could be.
Okay.
Yeah, it's one of those, it's a really easy project to show because it's on the panels are all cloth,
right.
So they can be rolled up and shipped.
Yeah.
So which is a really nice, it's a nice way to, and the material process too is really important because the material has a body, just like the homeless people have bodies, and we walk by them all the time. And so in the sense, these photographs are stand-in. Right,
mm-hmm.
There are these bodies, and they move when you walk past, and the fabric floats. So it's like, but it's also like the fabric that can be used in making some kind of structure to live in. So, so the material is also really important, and also being black and white, and you know, there's all those kinds of things around. You know, every choice we made in creating the research and disseminating and showing it is very carefully thought out.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
And how many people were involved in that project?
Probably about core group of maybe 7 or 8, mm-hmm. 8 and maybe 12.
Wow.
Yeah. We did 2 projects together. Another one that was called Asleep in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I forget the names of these. But that was a fabulous piece, and it's been shown in 2 very different forms. One was during Nuit Blanche,
mm-hmm.
and that was at Church in Maitland, where we projected the images that people had created, again, many, many images, about how Toronto is asleep to homelessness, right, and to the contributions of homeless citizens. So that's really what that project was about. And so we created again, looking at the material culture of homelessness, we created a screen made of the covers of mattresses that have been discarded. So
right.
And so those all together, it's this huge screen that's like 18 by 20 feet or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked beautiful.
I remember seeing it. It was really powerful.
Yeah. And then we showed it in a different situation because that has to be shown at night.
Right.
So then we were invited to a different exhibit space, which was bright.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worked with it, with all the material, and I was having a really hard time finding the people in the project. And this is another thing about doing research with people who aren't housed in traditional kinds of ways, is that you have no way of contacting them. So I would look and, you know, say, so-and-so, let's meet here, and there's no clock, there's no calendar, like many people have in our culture.
Right.
So there's a different sense of time and being in time and space. So I was feeling kind of like, oh, here on, we've got this project going. We have a chance to show it again. What should I do? And trying to stay congruent with the group,
mm-hmm.
right, and their desires. So I ended up going through several conceptions of it, and with the guys I could find, running it past them.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll go, yeah, no, yes, no, you know,
right.
with me around it. And so finally, I set upon a form of like bed sheets, of small blankets that have their stories, like the stories like that we projected, with kind of the idea of being asleep. So the sheets are on mattresses, and the mattresses are all from a shelter. They were donated, and these small little blankets or sheets don't quite cover the mattress, and it's kind of symbolic of how, you know, you're never quite covered.
Right.
Nothing covers you. There's no cover for you when you're homeless.
Mm-hmm.
You're always out there, and if you sleep out, there's always some part of you sticking out. Mm-hmm. You know, that's too cold. So these this piece is puts these sheets on there, and there's like at the top there's large letters that say like asleep or fatigue, tired, and those kind of words that mean to be asleep, so that people kind of, it really resonates with people. We really wanted that language to resonate. And then there's a large quote, and then at the bottom there's an image of someone sleeping. So it really, I think it was quite powerful as an exhibit. It was at Metro Hall.
Right. And that was about a year ago or so.
Yeah, I know. Time flies.
So you've been involved in a lot of really phenomenal projects. And so you just spoke about A Day in the Life and Asleep in Toronto. So would you say those are the two that were the most meaningful to you? Or
no, they're all meaningful. I'm working now in another area. I mean, I'd love to continue working there. But we go where grants are successful.
Yeah.
And the last one we wrote was not. So now I'm working with a women's shelter in a different part of the city. And we did a kind of a research and development grant where we were looking at trying to do a huge amount of change and shifting for these women that live in this shelter long term and short term. It's a 77 bed women's shelter in Toronto. And we realized that we were working at a pace faster than the women wanted to, so we slowed it down.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's another thing is for researchers working in this area is you have to go slowly. The work on all levels is slow, like whether you're trying to create change politically or work with people, and you have to attune to their needs.
Mm-hmm.
So about halfway through the project, and like, you know, you're balancing too, because you've written a grant and you're working with your community partner, and the community partner wants X to happen, and you said in the grant Y is going to happen, and then you're with doing the actual work and Z is happening, so you figure out why, and so that you can, when you write your final report, you can tell them what exactly happened and why you made the changes you did, so that it can be a successful project. And it was, and we got refunded, so we're going to be starting again, and we're just waiting for the second half of the funding, we hope, come through, and we should know in about a week or so.
Good luck.
Thanks. Yeah, because we've gotten to the point where we've gotten a lot of the stories of the women, and we have a lot of the imagery, and now we want to start putting it out into the neighborhood in larger forms, and also continuing to work with them around issues of identity, of community. A lot of times women who are homeless are often misidentified, as prostitutes,
right.
As whatever, but they're harassed. And even if they are working, they might be off that day, right?
Right, yeah.
But anyway, it's like it doesn't matter. They're harassed for whatever reason, for the way, they're carrying, often a lot of items with them. The same as men, they're carrying their lives with them a lot of the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they have no place to put things down. So this is one of the, in this neighborhood, to make people aware what these women are doing, where they're living, that this is an actual part of the community, that this shelter is a part of the community. It's not separate. These women's lives are not separate from the lives of the other citizens in the community.
And you spoke about slowness, and it sounds like there's a lot of listening involved in your work. Like, you do a lot of listening to everything, like even everything that you use in your work. And given your knowledge and your experience, what kind of advice could you give to other researchers who are starting to become involved in homelessness research?
I think what you just said, listening.
Yeah.
Listening to the people that you're working with. From the inception of an idea, you go in with an idea, you build a partnership, and you go slowly, and you listen, and you make mistakes, and you do your best to do reparative work, so restorative, and like restorative work for yourself and reparative work within the community.
Mm-hmm.
And just know that there's always going to be errors in research, I think. And the more human you are in the research, the more room there are for showings of grace around mistakes and things, right? Because people are real back to you. So you really, you have to know your community. You can't move quickly. I mean, I've seen projects, and I've been part of projects that have tried to go in quickly, and you can do them, right? They're very different.
Right.
Like, I'm involved in one now where where we don't live in the area, where we went in and we had to have like a cultural interpreter take us around, right? Which was a very interesting process. I'm still involved in that project. We're not done. But it looks at, you know, suburban versus urban homelessness. So this is very much a suburban setting that we've gone into, but without the kind of knowledge that I might have, like with street health or in the other community I'm working with, where I'm very much a part of that community. This one I'm not, so it felt strange. And I think it's really important for researchers to recognize the amount of connections they have with the community. So we had to build strong connections with a peer from that community who was then, you know, the person who introduced us to everybody.
Right.
And was trusted. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, and that's such an honorable thing for him to do. So we, you know, actually there was a couple, and then another guy as well who took us around and introduced us and showed us things. So they're very much inviting us into their homes, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's a different form. I don't think I like it as much as a researcher. I'm not sure, because maybe it's too fast. I don't know.
Right, yeah. And how did you become interested in research regarding homelessness?
Yeah, that's a long story too. I mean, I think there's multiple levels of why I'm interested in this. Part of it's my own experience. Part of it's the political face. Part of it's around human rights issues. The fact is that, you know, my reasons for being involved change, and I look right now and I think one of the reasons I'm involved is because there has been no shift. And I look at so many people are precariously housed. We're in a recession right now. It's a really important area to, you know, be committed to because of this, right? Regardless of what kind of history people have, whether they as researchers haven't, you know, have lived in poverty, have lived as homeless, have lived, you know, with multiple kinds of oppressions, whether they have or not. I don't think it really matters, but I think the commitment is really key. I've lost the question though. Did you?
I was just wondering what it was that made you so interested in homelessness research.
I think I remember, I've been involved in this for so long, like doing tent cities in Halifax, and I'm writing a lot about it now, about that stuff, and so it's coming out in new ways, a kind of, you know, my own experiences, and how do I relate those to other people's experiences who've lived lives that are more in the margins,
right?
And then how do you transition them to make a difference, and then how do you make an impact? So it's about power. You know, you go from a place of no power to a place of power, or maybe an illusion of power.
Right.
A hopefulness around power to shift things. And I think that's where I am with it right now, is that maybe the work that we're doing, because it's so powerful and good, there will be opportunities now for people to see it and recognize it more as a potential experience for anyone.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
What would you say is the main thing that you hope to achieve with your research and with your art and your teaching?
Yeah. Educating people, shifting people's perceptions of what it is to be homeless, shifting the language of homelessness from this idea that we're going to end it to instead to have more of a rights focus, that people have a right to housing. It's not about ending homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
That's never, I don't even think that's really going to ever happen for so many reasons. But to enter, to change the discourse to a rights-based discourse, I think it's crucial so that those people who want housing are guaranteed it. I mean, we are guaranteed it.
Right.
It's just not there. So there's this huge gap. There's an emptiness for, you know, around rights.
Right. So you're talking about giving people more choices and
Yeah,
there's this huge notion about ending homelessness and
And the people I talk to in the street don't really think that's gonna happen either.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's a discourse that's come not from the street but from people outside of the community. And again, so how do we listen?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. And carefully with people who have solutions. Involve the people in the solutions.
Right.
This has been going on for so long, and people have been excluded from being involved in solution making. They're seen as a problem, when actually they are not. It's the structural aspects of our culture that are problems,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
And it's enacted upon them. Yeah.
Hmm. Okay, and I know that you've spent a lot of time sort of like walking around the city and taking a lot of photographs and exploring and speaking to people. And so I was wondering if maybe you could just talk a little bit about the hidden places that people in the city live in.
Oh, yeah. There's so many of them. And one of the problems, I mean, going around over the years is that they get walled up.
Mm-hmm.
They get bricked off. They get chain-linked, fenced. You know, people get moved on. And it's a huge issue in the city because people are being pushed further and further out, away from any resources that they have access to. People are amazingly resourceful in where they'll sleep, whether it's, you know, the lobby of a bank or, you know, places where you put your clothes, you know, clothes bins for recycling clothes.
Mm-hmm.
People stay up all night, you know, coffee shops. People ride the buses. The ravines. Toronto's full of ravines. There's lots of people living in them. But again, they're being pushed further out, and the places in the ravines that felt safe
mm-hmm.
are being blocked up, you know.
Yeah.
And there's you know, more private security around than there ever used to be.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the people also who will say, well, you don't have a right to be here. Move along. You know, this space. So there's you know, contentious issues around public space
mm-hmm.
and private space.
Right.
Because for someone who's homeless, this is private space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's their
yeah.
home. And for someone else, no, it's public space. So there's this kind of real tension around, you know, who's going to win this struggle. And we know who it is, of course. It's not the person who's de-domiciled. It's the other guy, right?
Yeah.
So there's, I mean, I think that you can walk through so many alleys, and unless you've got a sense for it, unless you're really looking, you're not going to see it.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to perceive it, and I think that's actually a good thing, because it makes it more dangerous for people. The more people know that they're there, the more dangerous it is for them.
Hmm.
And I worry sometimes, you know, about bashing, you know, homeless bashing, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
People don't, some people, I don't know why, don't, you know, it's like they don't like this, you know, like that, they just, oh, all homeless people are, you know, X, Y, or Z.
Right.
It's like they then, you know, begin to create a violent interaction,
mm-hmm.
right, rather than any kind of compassionate interaction with the person.
Do you think that, do you think it could ever be like the other way around, where if people start to know about these hidden places where people in the city live, like, could it create more of like a shift towards change? Like,
I don't know. I worry, because I know I just became aware of a situation just in a suburban area where people found out about certain people living in certain areas, and they were moved along. So what happens usually is they get moved along.
Yeah.
So it's not about our community saying, oh, here you are,
mm-hmm.
well, can I bring you some coffee in the morning?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
you know, the idyllic kind of,
let's
all live together,
yeah.
which would be fabulous as far as I'm concerned. Instead, it's no, you're kind of messy, and, you know, you don't have access to, you know, showers, to water, to cooking, to la la la. So this isn't appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all have to live one way.
Yeah.
And we don't. We live in diverse ways already.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just own it, you know, and open up to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very well said.
Yeah.
And what, in your opinion, is one of the city's, like, greatest needs?
More, well, part of me wants to say more beds,
mm-hmm.
And then the other part wants to say more money, but properly spent, you know.
Yeah.
Healthcare services for people who are on the streets is needed, water resources. I mean, we need to recognize that the problem needs diverse solutions.
Mm-hmm.
Not one. I think right now, as a city, we're trying to create one solution for all people,
yeah.
and it's not working.
Mm-hmm.
People are being moved out into areas, again, where they don't feel safe, where there's no supports for them. I mean, think about your own community and where you want to be. We all have certain amounts of choice in that, to the best of our capacity. And then to imagine having no choice and being moved far away from services with no ability to, you know, no money for the subway, no money for anything, and then you don't have food, and all the food banks are far away, and any volunteer work you were doing is far away.
Yeah.
And I think that's another thing, is that people forget that people who are homeless do a lot of work in our city that's invisible.
Mm-hmm.
They are, they give back to the city, and I mean, that's what one of the things that Asleep in Toronto was about, was we're asleep to the contributions of homeless citizens. They have their own healthcare system, you know, they mm-hmm. have their own educational system. All these things are mm-hmm. operating as a subculture.
Right.
Yeah. And we have lots to learn.
Yeah. So I'm just going to shift the interview a little bit more towards to youth homelessness and sort of the issues that queer homeless youth face.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering, like, what kinds of barriers do you think that people who are trying to get support from this system that we have, what kind of barriers do they face?
Oh, homophobia.
Yeah.
Huge one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Youth phobia.
Yeah.
Right? Ageism.
Yeah.
You know? That no one understands, like, that being an adolescent is such a period of flux and change, and there needs to be safety, right? Youth are in situations of violence often, so they have to leave their homes
mm-hmm.
When they identify, when they come out, and then they come out into a city where there's no spaces that are safe for them.
Yeah.
And it's a huge problem, so they end up in other more encounters of violence
mm-hmm.
and more trauma, and that leads to lots of, you know, things like self-medicating, all that kind of stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is, again, highly problematic when it's used for a long period of time.
Right.
And becomes like the only kind of way of taking care of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we need more safe shelters. We need more workers who are aware of the issues of queer youth. Because they're different. Their issues are different, right? And the
mm-hmm.
trans youth, the issues are different as well.
Yeah.
Because they're coming into a culture where they're, you know, as that they're very othered.
Yeah.
And so how can we work on that to make it safer? I mean, we just had Pride. I don't know if Pride would ever have as its, you know, forward marching kind of, you know, the group of the week, you know, of that year as homeless queer youth,
yeah.
you know, a push for that. That would be amazing.
That would be amazing.
You know, a lot of money could be raised at Pride for that kind of a project.
Yeah, I agree, for sure.
Yeah. It would be great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because to have a safe shelter for youth to go to would be amazing.
Yeah.
Toronto doesn't have one.
No, Toronto doesn't have any sort of emergency crisis shelter for LGBT youth.
Yeah.
Do you think that would be appropriate?
More than appropriate. I think it's an essential need.
Yeah.
Again, because of we're raised, all of us are raised in this culture, and it's a homophobic, racist, ableist culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I've even talked about, you know, ableism or disability, right?
Yeah.
You know, and all the issues that go along with that, and with shelters and shelters. You know, there's no understanding
mm-hmm.
of the multiple intersections of people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
Once you're on the street for a little while, you often have, I don't know what to call it, earned a disability
mm-hmm.
in some way, you know, it's your street cred maybe, you know,
mm-hmm.
because you've been there, and there's violence and there's sadness
mm-hmm.
on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
There's incredible sadness, I know. When I walk down the street sometimes, I just walked by a man on my way here,
mm-hmm.
and he looked so dejected, and I said hi, and he couldn't even respond. So, you know, we need a lot of people in the city who have time to sit down and talk to people.
Yeah.
Who sit with them right where they are.
Yeah.
And talk with them. I don't see that happening a lot.
No.
I do it, and mm-hmm. I see other people do it on occasion, but
yeah.
Whether it's a youth or an older person or a frail person, you know, talk to people in the streets. Again, that's what's needed in our city.
Mm-hmm.
Breaking down those barriers between, you know, us and them,
yeah.
those others
yes.
who are so different. They're not so different.
Mm-hmm.
So many of them held jobs and
mm-hmm.
still hold jobs. So all these mythologies need to be, you know, taken apart.
And how do we even begin to do that?
Yeah,
that's the question.
Well, I mean, I think people have been doing it for years and years and years, and it's a slow-moving thing, and we
yeah.
keep doing it. So researchers dedicate their lives to it,
mm-hmm.
and hopefully some media people also dedicate their lives to it. And, you know, I think, you know, the Homeless Hub is a good thing at York because they're looking at creating school curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
So the earlier it gets into school curriculum,
yeah.
So this understanding of what homelessness is, what poverty is, how it's created by structures in our society, not by people themselves.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
A huge message
yeah.
that needs to be gotten out because so many people do not understand homelessness as a structural issue. They
mm-hmm.
understand it as an individual problem,
yeah.
and it's not.
Mm-hmm. This actually leads right into my next question. I was just wondering what you would say, like in your opinion, what do you think would be the top few reasons that youth become homeless?
Violence. In their homes, in their personal lives. Issues of coming out
mm-hmm.
Is a huge one. I think probably those are the two biggest ones. And I think sometimes poverty also leads to children leaving as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because in a household that can lead to more tensions. I'm not saying that all poor families have tensions in them,
right.
but there can be more. In my mind, I'm thinking of specific instances. But I think any home, any place where there's a lot of tension, where we as a culture hold up families as this iconic image, but we still don't always know how to parent. We don't know how to be together as families.
Mm-hmm.
So when there's anything that's seen as not normal in a family, like a child coming out or a child being different, sometimes the default position is one of anger and violence rather
yeah.
than curiosity and let's figure, you know, oh, okay, this is okay. You know, I'm kind of uneasy with it, a parent might say, but let me get some information.
Mm-hmm.
Sit and tell me about it. Again, that listening, that slowing down, rather than jumping into like a kind of more aggressive stance. Which
mm-hmm.
we see happening with kids because we see them on the streets with bruises.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
again.
That's so
yeah.
not okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's that whole thing around normal again, like that one size fits all approach where, you know, it's like one service for everyone
yes.
and assuming that there's like this normal person.
Yeah, and there's not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea of the norm comes from the Carpenter Square,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Which I love, you know. We're not blocks of wood.
Mm-hmm.
We're living, breathing pieces of flesh that move.
Mm-hmm.
So the norm doesn't really work well as a concept.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm. And like the issues of homophobia and homelessness, like they're so complex.
Oh yeah.
How do you think that we could even begin to sort of unravel the complexities, if we even could, and do you believe that we ever really will?
Well, I think that work you've done
mm-hmm.
has great possibility, right? Around, you know, that beginning piece to just begin to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
We know that there's no not even any literature in this area, right? As researchers,
right? Yeah.
right? We know this, so we need to get more studies funded. We need to understand more, and then put that material out into culture, hoping that it'll create change.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm an optimist
mm-hmm.
in the end, a slow optimist. I think it's a new movement called slow optimism.
That's great.
Yeah. But, you know, like, I'm glad you're doing the research you're doing because, you know, it's really key for these kinds of changes to move forward. And the more messages repeated, the more likely someone's going to hear it, I hope. Mm-hmm. And the more different forms it takes, whether that's, you know, again, a report to City Hall, or, you know, a video that's on YouTube, mm-hmm. or a series of postcards, or an art exhibit, or people talking to each other in the streets. It's getting it out there over and over and over again, and lobbying, mm-hmm. And then taking a bit of time off and sleeping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm thinking there of, you know, despair and empowerment work, how, you know, you're trying always to, like, be out there and create change, and then there's often, like, a cycle, then you feel a little despairing that, oh, gosh, there's not enough change, it's too slow, mm-hmm. and you take a little bit of time and do some restorative work, and then you go back to it.
Right.
You know, it's a little cycle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It works. Yeah.
It works, because, you know, I'm committed to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think that Toronto is a safe city for youth who are homeless and LGBT, like, in comparison to other sort of maybe cities in Canada that you've been to?
No. I don't think so. I think there's an incredible amount of youth violence directed towards youth. The youth is targets for violence, mm-hmm. Because they're more vulnerable as a population. Hmm. And I'm not sure what police statistics show, or even if they gather stats on this, because the other thing is people have to report it, mm-hmm. and why would somebody report it when they know that they're not going to be believed or listened to or heard?
Exactly.
So that's another reason we need a safe shelter, so that there could be intermediaries, there can be advocates for people, for youth when they're experiencing violence on the streets. They can go to that place and then have someone advocate with them around, you know, decreasing the levels of violence. Because it takes a lot to move forward, mm-hmm. To talk about violence in the intra and interpersonal sphere. Mm-hmm. It means re-traumatizing the person, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's a huge risk, mm-hmm. you know, because if there's no supports, what do you do? If you know that you can go someplace and talk about violence against, you know, a young woman because she's queer. And then she's got to repeat everything, mm-hmm. and repeat it and repeat it. And she's almost, rather than being the kind of the person who's been victimized by a crime, is now all of a sudden, you know, on trial. Mm-hmm. Is she telling the truth?
Right.
Right. Is he telling the truth?
Yeah, exactly.
You know. And then there's a matter sometimes, too, of even finding the people who are the perpetrators of violence. Right? Mm-hmm.
Hmm. And this sort of homophobic violence, like, that happens in the shelter system, do you think that, like, more of it comes from staff members working in the system, or from other youth who are in the services?
I think both.
Yeah.
Because I think homophobia is so ingrained. Mm-hmm. I always love that Robertson Davies quote, you know, what's bred in the bone, out's in the flesh. Hmm. You know, so what we're taught, you know, we pick it up unconsciously in our culture.
Yeah.
And unless we're reflective, you know, we repeat it. Mm-hmm. And if there's no one there to call us on it, we're going to keep repeating it because, wow, we can. Mm-hmm. And it's again, it's the normal environment. It's okay. Yeah. Everybody's doing it. So what if you upset the queer youth? There's only a couple of them here, right? Big deal.
Yeah.
You know, suck it up or whatever, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, rather than seeing that this is, you know, this is actually a human rights issue. You're not allowed to say certain things, mm-hmm. in this country. And, you know, so education. Mm-hmm. Shelter workers often, I mean, they have a very difficult job. They don't get paid very much. Their job is extremely important. Mm-hmm. Make sure they're well-educated. Make sure that they're getting enough time off. Make sure that they're getting, you know, anti-oppressive workshop trainings from the youth themselves. Mm-hmm. I think there's no better teacher than people who've been through it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And no better workers sometimes, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, but again, then we have to talk about educational credits and how do you, you know, they don't have them, and how, mm-hmm. how do you set up the systems of equivalency for people? You know, again, we have one, you know, they have to go through this and this program and that program, and mm-hmm. then we'll get them a job. But, you know, a lot of these people are actually quite qualified to work in those positions. Mm-hmm. They have the knowledge.
Yeah. What kind of advice would you offer, like the current shelter system, in order for it to become queer friendly? Because it, like as you know, obviously, yeah, there's no shelter specifically for queer youth.
Yeah.
But so we just have this system right now to work with.
Yeah.
What do you think we could do to
sit down with queer youth and let them educate you?
Yeah.
Have them come in and do audits. You know,
mm-hmm.
have a queer youth task force in the shelter system that can go around and audit them and say, and talk to the people, you know, who are using the shelter and say, have there been episodes of violence? What has been the result? Have there been, when I say violence, I mean everything from name calling,
mm-hmm.
you know, to physical violence. So there's psychological, there's social violence, there's economic violence. It's a huge spectrum. So to find out exactly what kind of violence has been experienced, and how subtle, right, it is, because sometimes it's quite subtle.
Mm-hmm.
And just start keeping, it's like a it would be a research project,
right?
To have this going on in the city. And then do an intervention, right?
Mm-hmm.
Say, okay, like, now we know exactly what's going on. And we think that from what we're hearing, the best, you know, again, if it was community-based research, the solutions often are there.
Mm-hmm.
They come from the community.
Yeah.
You know, and it would come from also from working with the staff.
Right.
You know, it's not about kind of blaming or shaming people, but it's about getting everyone on board to do the same kind of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
It's the worst kind of pedagogy, right?
Yeah.
Like to blame or shame somebody.
Right.
Who's only doing their job and they don't know how to do it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And no one's mentored them,
mm-hmm.
you know, and maybe, you know, who knows what they're coming from each day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so
for sure.
I always say that. We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be so kind to each other.
Yeah.
Because we just don't know.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And is there anything else that you wanted to sort of add in?
That's it. Homelessness. No. No, I'm really happy to talk. And, you know, I just hope we can create change for the people who are living. And that, you know, for the citizens who you know, in this instance of being under-resourced, of being de-domiciled, of not having enough, even choices are provided with more choices around how to live their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And that we listen. They have the solutions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really great. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge.
Thank you.